Somewhere across the bifrost, way up high.
Welcome back to the latest episode of Across the Bifrost. My name is Sung Soo, and joining me, as always, is my dear friend and co-host Pat Dunford from Across the Pond. And today, well, I'm not going to lie, we kind of got a hodgepodge episode today, but there's a lot of stuff to cover. There's not a lot of cohesion between everything we're going to cover, except it's all about Marvel Crisis Protocol. But first, Pat, how you doing?
I'm doing great, TT. Boy, do I love talking about Marvel Crisis Protocol. So I'm not at all concerned about the hodgepodge of stuff. AMG just released a bunch of different rules updates, right? We've got affiliation updates, we've got a rudder, we've got BNR changes. So we thought we'd bunch it all together in one place for easy reference.
Yeah, and before we dive into that, though, we do want to talk about MCP to all of you. And you can go to acrossthebifrost.com/Discord, get our new public Discord, public-facing Discord server, and talk to Pat and I. Because, hey, we really like that. We enjoy it. We talk about MCP a lot, but you know what? We haven't quite talked enough. So can we start with Sleeve It or Heave It, Pat? Because that's kind of like a cult favorite we kind of stumbled into here. Is it okay if we do a Sleeve It or Heave It before we jump into this stuff?
Yeah, let's. Sleeve It or Heave It is becoming my favorite part of the pod, if I'm being honest. And the one that I wanted to pick this week was Recalibration Matrix, a classic that came out, I think, originally with MODOK. So way back when the game first came out, and has seen a reprint, two reprints, in fact, one with Domino and Cable and one with Vibranium Heist.
So Recalibration Matrix is an interesting one. Way back in the day, Jay and Greg were talking to me about what they should name their podcast. And they ended up picking Recalibration Matrix because they thought it was going to be a very heavily played, ubiquitous card. Mm. And I almost never see this card anymore. Do you see it anymore, Pat?
Very rarely. And it's interesting because at a glance, it does seem like it should be more popular, right? It gives you very reliable dice fixing in a game where dice are very swingy and actions are limited. So the option of fixing an activation by rerolling all the dice is pretty appealing.
Let's go ahead and go through the card, though. So, right, it's an unaffiliated reactive card. When an allied character is attacking or defending before they calculate success or failure step at the end of the modified dice step, it may spend 3 power to play this card. The attacking and defending characters reroll all of their attack and defense dice. So, yeah, it's an interesting card. And like you said, it does bring you some consistency. The fact that it has to be a both sides reroll has always been a, you know, internet complaint about the card.
Yes, and it's got some weird quirks that trip people up, especially newer players. You see a lot of questions from newer players about this card. The first quirk is that because it's just a normal reroll, you don't reroll failures, right? You don't reroll your skulls. But this particular card trips people up because it feels like, the way it's framed, right, it feels like a total reset. Do you know what I mean? Oh, we pick everything up and roll it again. So people naturally want to reroll their skulls, but they can't. So obviously that's important and means that it can't necessarily save you from a bad roll, unfortunately. The other thing that trips people up is because it happens at the end of the modified dice step, you don't get a chance to use any other dice modification, right? So you do all of your other dice modification first, like, for example, your defensive reroll for being an inhuman, your offensive reroll for Mantle of the Black Panther, your modifications for cover, changing attacks to blanks because of things like Pierce or MODOK's defensive ability, right? All these different things in the game that modify dice, they all happen, and then they all get thrown out of the window, right? And we just do a straight roll for our attack or defense with no frills.
Yeah, so it's definitely interesting from a timing standpoint, and it's kind of a weird card. I wish I had a better place to put it. I like that it doesn't reroll skulls, because when my opponent has rolled a couple of skulls, I'm more incentivized to use a recalibration matrix. With it being double-sided, right, you can obviously use it when you've rolled poorly, when your opponent's rolled hot, or both. Both instances occur. So there's definitely some things with it. I do think it's a little expensive. And I do want to ask you at a higher level, Pat, how many tactics cards do you normally see dedicated to dice fixing?
You don't see many, do you?
That's kind of the reason we don't see the card a lot.
Well, there aren't that many cards that do fix dice. to be fair. There's a couple of cards that are similar to this one, like Kunlun Training and the
Convocation has one, right? Iron Books?
Beg your pardon?
Iron Books, isn't that what it?
No, not really. That's more. That's the one that lets you count physical attacks as mystic. I think you might be thinking of Brotherhood that have the Books of Truth. That's the Brotherhood book theme one that gives you a reroll similar to a calibration matrix. And then there's also that one that came with Sam Wilson that has a picture of Lizard yelling at someone that lets you reroll some dice. That's a very helpful description.
Yeah, yeah. That's super helpful. That's okay.
But the point is, there aren't that many. The one that sees quite a lot of play is Bats the Ghost Hound in Midnight Suns, Midnight Suns specific card. But even that is not ubiquitous, right? You don't see it all the time.
Planes of Poldark, that's what I was thinking of, which is like the Convocation Dark Reign, right?
Yeah, I consider that a bit different because that's not really giving you a do-over so much as just amplifying everything. Right?
That's very fair, yeah.
And I think those kind of amplification effects, like Planes of Poldark, are actually very good. I think those cards are excellent.
Yeah, and I think that's where it comes to me, is I normally, my brain will compare the two, because they're both dice fixing or smoothing one way, right? And Planes and Dark Reign are impacting multiple roles, right? Where Recalibration Matrix is just a single attack and defense role. But
yes.
I guess it's multiple roles, right? One for you, one for them. I don't know. I've never valued a single attack that much to the point where I want to take Recalibration Matrix as my thing.
Yeah, it's definitely a weaker effect than something like Dark Reign, but of course you have the advantage that you can also use it defensively, right? Whereas Dark Reign is purely offensive, and of course Dark Reign is an affiliated card, as a Planes of Poldark, and this isn't. So this one is a bit more flexible. I think this card shines when you're in situations where, one, you're happy not to reroll skulls. So if, for example, you have a character with Beality Gem, or you have Scarlet Witch, then not re-rolling your skulls, but re-rolling everything else becomes advantageous. Or two, if you're facing off against people that have a lot of dice modification and your team doesn't, right? If your team is just getting their advantages through pure numbers, like for example, your Asgard team and all your attacks are rolling 6 dice and all your defense are rolling 4 dice with no modification, compared to a team like Wakanda, where they're rolling lower numbers than you, but then they've got their King of Wakanda reroll, their Shuri reroll, their dice modification from their character's abilities, right? In those kind of circumstances, that disparity is going to make Recalibration Matrix a stronger card.
So I do have a question with you. The power is my other concern on it, Pat, right? So when you're looking at it from an attacking standpoint, the attacks I normally want to reroll are going to be my big attacks, which is quite often a spender.
Yeah,
it's hard to make sweeping generalizations with 125 characters, but for the purpose of this, that's the generalization I'm going with. Defensively, I definitely understand sometimes I'll have 3 power, but 3 power is just a lot.
It is a lot, and I think that is the biggest problem with this card, is that it's just too hard to have 3 power at your disposal when you need a reroll, and the opportunity cost of spending that 3 power is just a bit high. Now, don't get me wrong, there are certainly times when it's well worth it, right? And one of the things that we like to say, TT, as a rough guide, is if a tactics card can give you an action, it's pretty good. Well, a full reroll on an attack roll that's otherwise done nothing is like giving you another chance of that action, right? So to use your example, if I spend 3 power to use my spender and then it just flubs and does nothing, well, I can spend 3 power of the Recalibration Matrix, and it's like I've got another spender, right? I've just bought myself another action to do the same thing again. I get a do-over. That can be really good, but yeah, you just don't have the power that often.
Yeah, I remember way back in the day, someone was excited about it. It was like Recalibration Matrix, Execute, and Corvus. But I'm like, okay, that's a lot of power we're sitting on here.
Wait. Why would you want Execute and Recalibration Matrix? Surely you don't need both? Like, they're both messing with your opponent's dice.
It's the reroll in case Corvus flubs.
Okay, so this is like an insurance policy.
It's just like we're spending multiple tactics cards just to make sure Corvus dazes or KOs that character.
Yeah, I think you've just made me realize why dice manipulation cards aren't that popular. And it's because so many team tactics cards give you reliable, proactive things to do. And you just don't need to spend them on an insurance policy, especially when that insurance policy is expensive and unlikely to pay off.
Yeah, so it sounds like we're both heaving recalibration matrix.
Yeah, I mean, I've had quite a few rosters where it's made the cut and then been muscled out. I think you could put it in if you don't have five cards that you're happy to take in every situation. But that's probably not going to be very many teams.
It's getting harder and harder to build a team where you don't have five cards you're really happy to shove in. But
yeah, I mean like universal cards, right? Because you can get teams where you have great cards, but they're all tied to characters or they're all starting to fill specific niches. Like, I want this card for this crisis. I want that card if I face this opponent. And you might realize, hold on, if I just face a regular team with no tricks and I don't take like this one character that's carrying two tactics cards, then I just don't have five cards I want. That's the kind of circumstance where one, like recalibration matrix is always fine, right? It might not be the best card, but it always does something useful. That insurance policy can be helpful. So that's the situation I take it in. But yeah, right now I don't have a team like that. So I'm also heaving it.
All right. So let's stay on the tactics cards review. And one tactics cards got updated, and that was Doomed Prophecy. It's something we alluded to back when we talked about the card initially, right? Doomed Prophecy, two big changes, right? Just one change, but two changes in the last couple months. It got moved off the restricted list. And as a reminder, Doomed Prophecy was made an Asgard-only card. Was it about 2 months ago, Pat?
Yeah, back in November. It's an Asgard-only card, and you can only play it on Asgardians. So you can't have any nonsense where you take like Carnage in your Asgard team and play this card on him. Removing this from the restricted list, I think, is a pretty big deal. We talked a few months ago when it was moved to Asgard that it is a pretty powerful card, and there are some Asgardians that make good use out of it, but taking up a restricted slot was a high price to pay. Well, now you don't have to pay that price. And I personally am very interested to see the impact this can have on Asgard.
So I see almost no Asgard. So I honestly don't know how much this impacts. It definitely doesn't hurt them, right? It gives them another tool they have in the toolbox. It allows them to open it up. We talked about having 10 wide. We just talked about, do you have certain matchups where you want to bring Doomed in? Absolutely. And then certain matchups where you don't. But I honestly just never really see Asgard, which is kind of an interesting thing to say. Like, I think the Asgardian characters in a vacuum are fine. I see a bunch of Asgardian characters in rosters. I just don't commonly see Asgard as a roster.
Yeah. I think this card being unrestricted helps give Asgard an identity in that it makes them another team who are good at the priority control. I have fewer characters than you. I'm going to get lots of dazes and KOs game plan because they have expensive characters, right? So they can play taller than most teams, right? So they have fewer characters than their opponents that are all better. But they don't really have very much dice fixing, right? They don't have a good way to guarantee their punch. And this card does that, right? It means you can activate with priority and murder some folks. So I like that it makes them better at that game plan.
Yeah, I think the flip on that is interesting. On your taller teams, right, the negative of Doomed Prophecy just hits a little bit harder. I've definitely Doomed Thor before way back in the day and feels great until Thor starts getting attacked and then we get sad. But
those 10 die strikes with the wild throw, it's pretty cool.
Pretty amazing. Not a bad time to have recalibration matrix, if we're being honest. but yeah, then when he starts getting rapid fired, I'm like, oh, this feels real bad.
So obviously the downside of Doomed Prophecy is still there and it's huge, right? I would say that Odin's Blessing is a legitimate way to make that a bit less painful for you.
Absolutely. Right?
You can absolutely have situations where your Doomed Prophecy character can survive one activation from the opposing team if you've got Odin's. Like, that's not impossible. And then I think the other thing is this probably is not like a turn two play, right? Even if in Asgard you have the power generation to use it on turn two, this is one of those later game plays where you're using it to, I think ideally, If your hand isn't forced and the game is going the way you want, you activate with priority, let's say on turn three, and you get KOs with this card, right? Multiple dazes and KOs, ideally at least one KO, removing characters who can then retaliate against your character with no defense, right? And I think that's the plan that Asgard wants to be having with this card.
Yeah, and for that reason, I've associated this card less with Thor and more with Angela. Because I think Angela kind of fills that well, right? And you're kind of banking on Heaven's Wrath giving you the additional attacks, right? We've Doom Prophecy and Rapid Fire has been talked about ad nauseum, right? And it's the same basic principle, right? Angela is able to make multiple physical attacks in a single activation and still bounce around and get on target with people. So it definitely doesn't hurt. I love that it's coming off the list, and I'm excited to see what those kind of like long-standing Asgard fans come up with it.
Yeah, I can't let you talk about Angela, who's a great choice, without also shouting out Valkyrie. She might just be the best Doom Prophecy target in the game anyway. And certainly, between Warrior of Legend and Dragonflang with the Flurry, she makes great use of it, and she's only 3 threat. So if you don't have a plan to keep your character alive afterwards, good old Valkyrie is there to be expendable.
All right, so one of the other changes that came through was a Sam Wilson leadership change. Pat, what happened to poor Sam?
Oh, poor Sam. So quite a few things happened in this change. It's easy to miss. I myself missed one of these things when I first read it through, because you're going through the errata, you're trying to figure out what changed. And there's two things that are important. The first is they added non-grunts to the description of friendly characters that trigger this leadership. So losing your shield agents or hand ninjas does not let you trigger the effects of Sam's leadership. Which, I'll tell you, TT, personally I'm a little bit sad about, because I was looking forward to doing some nonsense with that. But it's probably for the best that it's not allowed.
I think it's good that they reined you in. This is a good preventative, preventative intervention there.
It's for the best. And then the second point is that it now only triggers when your characters are dazed or KO'd by enemy effects. So there's a whole bunch of different ways that existed in the past to get extra mileage out of this leadership that have now been curtailed.
That, I think, is the bigger change. Obviously, I mean, one of them hasn't even impacted the game yet, right? But the number of times I've seen it trigger off of either crisis effects or your own vision, oh, I can't believe I beamed this character and they dazed, was pretty high. Yeah.
Yes. There are a lot of crises that damage your characters, right? There's like Merfisk, Terrigen Clouds, Gamma Wave, Mutant Madman, Cube Fragments. Like, a lot of crises could damage your characters. So it was pretty common with that leadership to have it trigger like once a game on average on those crises. So losing that, I think, is quite a big deal. And then I think it's probably for the best that you can't create combos where you're intentionally dazing your own characters for benefit. Although it's kind of cool. But the thing is, those things are only kind of cool when they're not good, right? You're like, oh, that's neat. You did something unusual and fun. Good on you. But when that's really powerful, it just feels a bit broken and abusive. And that's where we were with Sam's leadership, I think.
Yeah, and to be clear, like, I think we're both still really high on Sam. Sam's still a really powerful character. He just lost a couple tools out of his toolbox, but it's a wide and deep toolbox. So I'm not worried about Sam. I expect to see him in the upcoming TTS League quite a bit.
Yeah, me too. I'll probably see him in most games, as I'm probably going to be playing Avengers. So
I'll believe it when you submit your roster.
Yeah, we'll see.
So the other thing to come out of this were some affiliation changes. I'm going to run through the affiliation that got stuff, Pat, and then you tell me at a high level kind of what you think about these changes, right? So Brotherhood got Colossus, Gambit, and Rogue added to it.
This is huge. They also got Juggernaut. He's not in blue on the list because he was always on their card, but of course Juggernaut is now released. And I think these four characters are a massive game changer for Brotherhood. Juggernaut is superb and unique and completely changes options you have on the table for how you play. Rogue is a really high quality affiliated four in a roster that didn't have really any good four threats before. And Gambit and Colossus, and probably Rogue, might just be at their best under Magneto's leadership. Like, Brotherhood might be the best affiliation to get the most out of all of these characters.
Yeah, when we did the Colossus review, we talked about how is he going to get power. Well, that's obviously fixed. And when we did the Quicksilver review way back, we talked about how much Brotherhood needed another affiliated three, and they picked that up in Gambit. So some really nice additions there, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
The Defenders roster. Oh, go ahead.
I want to keep talking about this. I'm really excited for Brotherhood. So, like, one of the things we said with Gambit, right, was how power hungry he is. And if he can get a lot of power, he's going to be really, really good. I think this is that, Brotherhood is such a good home for him. Both of their leaderships help with power economy. And Brotherhood's three threat characters are not bad, but they're quite specialist. I think Gambit might become the go-to three threat affiliated character for Brotherhood. Or at least he's going to be up there with Mystique, vying for that top spot. And I also think Colossus is kind of perfect for Brotherhood, in that they have a lot of valuable characters who you want to protect. They have the power generation to turn his bodyguard on. He has a terrain throw to pay that back for Magneto if he does end up in a situation where he has excess power. And I think it's really neat that you can asteroid M him and you have a tactical choice of teleporting in a bodyguard, like where you need it on the table. I think that's really cool.
Circling back to Gambit, I think Gambit is going to be, I could agree with your take that he might even see more play than Mystique. And the big thing is, like, Quicksilver is a great character for what he does, right?
Yes.
But Gambit is just going to be more useful in more crisis game matchups, right?
It's that push, right? He has good damage output and he's got a push.
Yeah.
It's just really helpful.
Solid character, so. I hadn't considered the Motherhood... the Mothership.
Motherhood or Brothership, what are we calling it? The Asteroid M.
But that's kind of cool with the bodyguard coming in. So yeah, I like that. I can get behind that. It's a powerful card. But yeah, it could be, if that effect is what wins you the game, then by all means, yeah, get Colossus next to Magneto or whoever he needs to be next to.
Okay, I can see that sideways look you're giving me saying, come on, you're just going to use this on Magneto, surely. And if not Magneto, then Scarlet Witch. And yes, that's true. You probably are. But
it's good to have the
Bear in mind, you have to be holding... Like, if you're holding objectives, you can't teleport with this card, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you do end up in a situation where... Like, it comes up that things happen, right? Like, you're playing, Senators or Skrull or Alien Ship, and your Magneto is in a situation where he kills the person that's got it, and you're like, I guess I'm going to pick it up, but Asteroid M is offline. You know what I mean? And that sucks. Well, in this kind of circumstance where Magneto does actually have to commit to holding an extract, being able to then pull in a bodyguard to protect him is amazing. You're not going to feel bad about that at all.
Yeah, I mean, I've asteroided Toad before, so I understand that the games will dictate different play lines. I just literally hadn't considered it until you mentioned it, so yeah. Are we okay to jump to Defenders now, or is there more?
Okay, I don't have much to say about Defenders. They got magic, right?
They got magic.
She's neat. She's a powerful wizard.
Does help improve their tactics card selection?
Because of Journey Through Limbo?
Yeah. Is that might be... Okay, that's enough about Defenders. Uncanny X-Men got a whole bunch of characters, right? They got Colossus, Gambit, Honey Badger, Magic, Rogue, and X-23. That's a lot of X-Men.
They went from 7 X-Men to 13 X-Men overnight. Boom.
I think this is huge for them.
I
like X-Men a lot. I like that they have such a wide and diverse roster. They all have different synergies with each other. You're able to kind of pick the X-Men you want, given the crisis that comes out. I definitely like this a lot. You know, in our X-23 Honey Badger episode, oh man, time travel. Has that come out for people yet? That might not have come out for you yet, but hey, it'll come out soon if it hasn't. We talked about how much we love those characters. I guess behind the curtains, Pat and I are expediting this episode out because it's kind of time sensitive. Which does make a little bit of sense.
But I like where X-Men are right now.
Yeah. Well, two record. Yeah, we're jumping. Anyway, doesn't matter. I like where X-Men are. What do you have to say about X-Men?
Yeah, I really like them too. So they got a two-threat character, three new three-threat characters, and two new four-threat characters. That's really the bread and butter of your team compositions, right? It gives them a lot of options at every threat level. They already had a couple of fives. I think you can do some interesting wider teams with X-Men now, with your cheap leader in Storm. And a bunch of 3 and 2 cost affiliated characters plus some unaffiliated choices. I don't know how good it is, but giving everyone cover seems maybe good enough. Things like First Class get a bit better when you have a lot of X-Men. So I think it's worth exploring. I think they could do some interesting things.
I like First Class with them a lot. It can lead to some interesting interactions depending on the crisis things that come out there. So
yeah,
I do like that. The last affiliation to get touched is X-Force. And they just add Honey Badger and X-23, who, again, we're both really high on.
Yes. And of course, we knew that already they were getting Colossus. He was on their card, but this is his debut. I think this is almost as big a deal for X-Force as it is for X-Men, because it's a 2 and a 3 threat. X-Force have a 5-cost leader. So this brings down their cheapest affiliated core, right, of 3 characters, goes down to 10 threat, whereas before it was 11. And that gives you a lot more options, right? You can start splashing different characters in that mix. You can try different things. I think this is going to help X-Force a lot.
All right. So I think that kind of wraps up all the changes we have coming out of Atomic Mass Games, which were a lot. And I think we're generally behind most of them, right? Affiliation updates are always kind of my favorite. There's all this like guessing as to where things are going to go and some random stuff. Like, I don't know anyone that anticipated the all the Brotherhood changes. Like, those are really cool. And like Pat kind of talked about, it's a shot in the arm of just new life into some of these affiliations. So I think I love that the most. Sam change is great. Doom Prophecy is great. So yeah, great in general. We're fans.
Overall, we're happy with all of this, right?
So it's been a little while since we've done this, but we both kind of thought it would work out to do a couple rules review questions. What we're going to do here is we're going to grab a couple rulings. I don't like that, but I said it. Rules, rulings off of the forums and just kind of help bring them to people's attention. And for a bunch of different reasons, the card Sacrifice, which is an older card, has been seeing a lot of play recently, Pat. And all we kind of want to bring up is the last line of the card, which I think kind of gets missed a lot, right? And the last line is, it cannot add additional defense dice to its defense roll and cannot modify its dice during the attack. And I feel like that gets overlooked a lot, right, Pat?
Yes. It's really easy to overlook, and it's easy to forget how broad the restriction is. There's a lot of things that people take for granted in their rolling that are actually forbidden when you play Sacrifice. So this is obviously on the rules forum. Right. So if anyone wants to go and check this out, or if you don't believe us and you want to see for yourself, then you can check it out on the rules forum. It was actually ruled on back in September of last year. So it's been around for a while now. But one of the biggest things that this impacts that is, I think, the most unintuitive, as an example, is how it interacts with critical hits. Right. So Sacrifice says you can't roll extra dice in your defense roll. Critical hits give you extra dice. So when you play Sacrifice, your crits don't explode, which I tell you what, TT, I wasn't doing that, right?
No, it's like a mini grand illusion. I haven't played Sacrifice a whole lot, but I definitely know that a few of my opponents have missed this one. So it's a good one to bring to light, bring to surface. I still think the card's really, really good. If you don't want your X character to get hit with the Helios laser bombardment, you really don't care if the Sacrifice target rolls crits or not. But it's an important rule to remember that I do think a lot of people blip over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, having watched other people use Sacrifice as well, I think a lot of people just completely forget this restriction exists. And I've seen people modify their dice for cover after using Sacrifice, which of course is not allowed. I've seen people say, okay, I'm going to sacrifice onto Captain America, and then I'm going to use Vibranium Shield, trad 2 dice. That's not allowed. Right, I've seen people re-roll their defense dice with leadership abilities. So I would recommend anyone playing with or against Sacrifice be mindful of this effect and watch yourself and your opponent when you're using it, because it's so easy to make mistakes when you play this card.
Yeah, we're not implying anything malicious happens. It's just one of those weird interactions that people just kind of blip over sometimes. So what are the rules questions that you think we should go over this time, Pat?
So I had a couple that the accusers on the TTS Discord recommended. And the first is about movement and movement timing. And this is one that I'm particularly fond of because it came up for me way back in season two of the TTS League in the semi-finals game. I think it was semi-finals against Morgan. And I had it ruled against me, but I was in the right. And now I could finally prove it with this forum ruling that came, I don't know, like 16 months later.
Super convenient. Are you talking about the throw and collision damage timing?
Yes. So the point here is throwing a character and the collision that it causes. What is the timing on that? Because there's a bunch of effects that will trigger after an effect is resolved, and especially after a movement. So the question, TT, is if I throw a character into you and I damage you, at what point could you respond with an effect that cares about the movement of the throw?
And the ruling, as we see here from Thoris, is the collision is part of the movement. So you resolve the collision prior to rules that reactively trigger off the movement, triggering effect, which is very relevant for a lot of things. What was the specific thing with Morgan? Do you remember?
So the specific one was Black Panther pounce into Rocket. And what happened was his Black Panther pounced into Rocket. Rocket survived the pounce, which was fortunate. Rocket's not very good at surviving pounces. This is, of course, before he was nimble. These days, he's amazing at it. However, the damage he suffered from the pounce gave him enough power to then use booby traps in response to the pounce. So it was very important that the pounce fully resolves before Rocket has a chance to use booby traps. And this order means Black Panther moves, he damages Rocket, Rocket gains the power, and then Rocket has an opportunity to play booby traps, and he can use the power he's just gained from the pounce.
Yeah, the other one that I see come up for me in particular playing Web Warriors is a Spider Tracker, and it has to do with when an enemy ends a movement next to you, right? And similar thing there if we're doing off a pounce, right? The pounce would resolve, you take the damage, and then you tracker away from the person.
Yes. Now, I actually want to jump on you there, TT. I'm sorry you used this example, because this is another great rule question that came up that we want to talk
tracker
about.
Tracker movement action?
Tracker is movement action.
Okay, yeah, it doesn't work there.
And this is an important... I want to talk about this when we talk about rules, because I've had this come up basically every time I've played against a Web Warriors player. I'm sorry to throw you all into
it's fine.
Generalization. But it's a common mistake to make. I've had to stop Web Warriors players incorrectly using this against my Avengers all the time because Spider Tracker specifies movement action, right? And I had an opponent this weekend say to me, well, aren't all moves movement actions? So I think now is a great time to recap what actually is a movement action. I'm looking at you expectantly.
Oh, I'm supposed to do the recap? I'm sorry. So a move action, during a character's activation, they functionally get two actions. A move action is an action that then involves a movement, right? And then moves are defined later on as a bunch of different things. So a character's move action advance is the most common, where they'll walk into you. A pounce doesn't take an action, so therefore it wouldn't be a move action, which is why my previous statement was incorrect.
Yeah, exactly. So Spider Tracker triggers only when the character has spent an action to move, not on other movements. And it's a bit unintuitive because there aren't very many rules that care about that, right? Almost all superpowers that care about movement don't care about move actions. But also they care about different things, right? Some care about like advances. Some care about any movement. Some care about X, Y, or Z, right? So you need to look at each different rule carefully to see what will and won't trigger it. But for example, I have found Spider Tracker is pretty rubbish into my Sam Wilson Avengers because it doesn't trigger when I use my leadership. That gives me a short advance, but it's not a move action. And it doesn't trigger when I use Avengers Assemble, which is a short advance, but it's not a move action.
Yeah, I mean, the other place it comes up, right, charges specifically say you're going to take a move action followed by an attack action.
Yeah,
so it works. Which is different because I have heard people argue, I've made Corvus Glaive's attack action, and off of this action I get a move, and that is not a move action. That is a part of the attack action. So
yeah, on his spender, yeah.
Correct, yeah, off of Deathblow.
Yeah. So this is a complicated set of situations, and there's not really a hard and fast rule you can follow here to navigate out of it. You've just got to pay attention to what the rules in question say and make sure you're understanding them correctly. But the biggest thing to understand is that there's different kinds of moves in the game, and some are actions and some are not. And in fact, it's really helpful to understand what every kind of movement is, because different rules will care about different things. Another example that we wanted to talk about that people frequently get wrong is when you are doing an advance, right? An advance does not allow you to perform a climb, okay? These are two things that a normal move action would let you do, but there's loads of different effects in the game, lots of special rules that give your character an advance, right? I already mentioned Avengers Assemble and Sam Wilson's leadership, but for example, lots of spender attacks let you then advance afterwards. Lots of superpowers give you advances. But a climb, which is an advance using the short ruler over terrain of greater size than you, is not an advance, it's a climb. And basically nothing in the game gives you a climb action. The closest we get is climbing gear that gives you wall crawler plus an advance. So that kind of gets around it. It's important to keep in mind that when you are advancing your characters without a move action, you can't just climb.
Yeah, no, a good thing to toss out there. And there's been a lot of move shenanigans lately, especially with Juggernaut out there right now, who's doing all sorts of different movement tricks. One of the other things I've seen with people from different games, namely from War Machine, is that places are a type of movement. I know that in other games they are not, but if a character is placed next to you, that's a type of movement that's ended them close to you. So I think that's an important one to remember too. I see that mixed up from time to time as well.
Yes. And a couple of things that I think a lot of people know, but some won't, and that I think are worth repeating while we're on this subject. Juggernaut has made me notice people incorrectly using push, which is for whatever reason, because Juggernaut's push feels like a movement, people forget that when you push, you have to go the full distance. You can't push Juggernaut partly along the short tool and then stop to go where you want. But because Juggernaut's push feels like a moving, it kind of like creates this, I don't know, the shortcut in your brain kind of goes haywire and you're like, oh yeah, I'm moving Juggernaut along. I'll just put him where I want. No, if you're being pushed, you have to go the full distance. And that can sometimes get Juggernaut in hot water, where it is possible to like screw up and miss the objective you wanted to land on because you push and go too far.
So this is one that I've seen come up from time to time too, obviously, and I don't think either of us are rule sticklers, but once you commit to a push path, like that is the path that you are moving upon.
Yes.
So you get the tool down, you put the tool down, you say he's being pushed along this line, and if he doesn't hit the thing you hope he was hitting, then unfortunately he doesn't hit the thing you were hoping he would be hitting. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, because pushes have a little bit of uncertainty baked into them. They're slightly risky in that you can't always perfectly predict where you're going to end up after a push, and you can't always perfectly predict whether or not you'll be able to slide through a gap between two characters, for example. So by the letter of the rules, you're doing that with imperfect information, right? You're committing to a push and then you're seeing what you'll hit. And that might mean you end up where you don't expect.
Yeah. So just err on the side of caution. Instead of trying to get the perfect push, maybe make sure you get a push that gets you in range to make an attack if it's Juggernaut, or in range to pick up an objective if it's another. And if you lose a little bit of distance for your escape plan or something, that's you need the push to hit where you, and it really sucks if you miss.
Oh, yeah. I do that all the time when I'm throwing characters into terrain or other characters. Mm-hmm. Is you can sometimes try and figure out that perfect angle where you'll get them as far away from you as possible and still hit the terrain. But then I'll look at it and I'll think, yeah, but I could get this wrong. And then they're not going to hit anything. And I just nudge it slightly to the side and I accept they don't go quite as far, but then I guarantee to hit what I want.
Yeah, lose that half inch of distance, but just make sure that they hit the truck or whatever they actually need to run into.
Yep. Good advice.
Are there any other weird Juggernaut rules you've seen pop up? I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Something that we mentioned when we did our review of Juggernaut, but something that confuses people, this goes back to move actions, right? Juggernaut has a special rule that cares about move actions, which is he gets his power and attack. Let me actually, let me pull up his card and read exactly what it says.
After this character resolves a move action. Oh, do you have it up?
No, go for it.
After this character resolves a move action during its activation, it gains 2 power. The next attack made by this character with this activation adds 3 dice to the attack roll. This character can be affected by the superpower only once per turn.
Perfect. So everything we said about move actions already applies to this. If you were paying attention, you should see where I'm going with this point. But Juggernaut pushing himself with his own superpower, nothing stops the Juggernaut, does not trigger this effect, right? Because that push is not an action. And that is important to keep in mind. It's you can't necessarily do everything you want with Juggernaut every turn. You're kind of committing to spending one of his actions on a movement if you want to get the most out of him.
Yeah, so really good character, but yeah, just things to keep in mind. Juggernaut's a ton of fun to play, so I don't think it should change your opinion on the Juggernaut.
No, not at all. He's awesome. He's really good. Even when you are playing as Wills Crowley.
Yeah, that's true. You don't have to cheat to be good with Juggernaut. Are there any other rules you want to cover, Pat? Or is that kind of... I think that was all of them that we had lined up, right?
Yeah, that was everything we wanted to cover. Unless you get any... I don't think we're going to have any strokes of genius right now.
I guess the only other thing I want to bring out with Juggernaut, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I don't think anything's changed... But if Juggernaut is staggered, the first thing you need to do is nothing stops the Juggernaut.
Technically not the first thing you need to do, but it needs to be before either of your actions expect.
Right. So what I've seen people do is take the move action to trigger unstoppable momentum to then get power to use nothing stops the Juggernaut. But unfortunately, that doesn't work because your first action has to be a shake for that stagger. So you're not able to take that move. It just doesn't work in an ordering standpoint. I'm probably not explaining this very well.
Maybe I think you're explaining it well. I think there's one thing we should mention in case people are scratching their heads at this comment. Nothing stops the Juggernaut is an enormous paragraph of text. What TT is referring to is the final line that you might have overlooked that says, if this character has the stagger special condition, it loses it. Right, so this is a superpower you use during your activation that gets rid of stagger. But stagger means that you have to spend your first action shaking. How do you combo those things? Well, it's like you just said, right, TT? You have to have the power available and you have to use this superpower before you spend either of your actions.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people want to take a move action, use nothing stops the Juggernaut, and then drop the stagger. But by the time you take that move action, you've actually hit that weird thing where you have to shake the stagger at this stage.
Yeah.
So you can still have effective staggers on Juggernaut.
Yes, absolutely. He's not completely immune to it, right? He's sometimes immune to it. If you're doing lots of damage to him, he'll probably be immune. But even then, like forcing him to spend that power can also be relevant.
Yeah, and the Black Cat stagger is the one I see a ton of Black Cat nowadays, right? Black Cat being able to stagger him without fueling him up with power is the way I normally see the situation arise.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool combo.
All right, I think that wraps up our rules updates there. So we hope you found this episode enjoyable, entertaining. Hopefully it helps keep you up to date a little bit. We'll have links for all these form rulings on the description here. We hope you join us on the Discord, again, across the bifrost.com/Discord. Let us know what you think of the Sam Wilson change, the Doom Prophecy change. We'd love to see your Asgard rosters. We look forward to seeing a bunch of you in the Season 7 TTS League. Pat and I will both be playing. If you're interested in supporting the pod, you can jump over to patreon.com/AcrossTheBifrost. And of course, you can find all of our work over at AcrossTheBifrost.com. And Pat and I do have something cool, something a little different, something new coming out in the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned for that announcement as well. So till next time, everyone, cheers and happy gaming.
Across the Bifrost, way up high, there's a pod that I've heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere across that you dare to dream really do come true.